Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. This is another Venice episode. If you hear any background noise, it might be just the lyrical airs of the island as they waft over to us.
Italian pop music. It's verisimilitude. It's patio sounds.
Patio sounds. It's also inescapable, I promise you. And I'm here again with Glenn Kenny. Hello, Glenn.
Hi. I feel like, you know, I talked to you the second day of the festival. We got off and running with the Last Thing I Saw, and now I feel right that before I'm supposed to leave. And everybody who's staying longer than me tells me I'm here until the bitter end. And I guess it must get bitter. It can't get that bitter, though, because it's so pleasant out here.
That's true.
I think it only gets bitter if you push yourself very hard to see 4 or 5 films a day every day, which I stopped doing at a certain point. I realized 5 films a day was too much, and the 10 o'clock screenings wouldn't work for me, which I'll explain in a moment.
Yeah.
I feel like since we talked when I first got here, I've definitely, you've had one and I've had one, but we've both definitely had a journey through space and time.
Yes.
Like very surprising things have happened. Not in the world, which is nice. I mean, well, Kim Jong-un and Putin meeting, that's surprising.
Oh,
not surprising, but it's horrifying.
Yeah.
But so many unexpected delights. It's been a hell of a festival, and I've seen a lot of films. I've seen 20 films, which I don't normally see 20 films in a festival, and that's not counting the 5 films I saw in previews before I came out here. So I've seen 25 Biennale College films, and they've all been very, very interesting.
Oh, yeah. Do you want to talk a bit about that? Because that's something, those are films that people really don't always
Let
get
me
to.
Plug the Biennale College, because, you know, we're not in a crisis phase here, but, you know, I've been talking to the filmmakers as part of a panel of critics for the Biennale College, which awards €200,000 to 3 filmmaking projects every year. This year used to be €150,000. Now it's
€200,000. Wow,
because
it went up.
Yeah, it went up.
Okay.
And it's not a lot of money, but it's like Mel Brooks, when he was talking about his early days, he said, you know, for me, making money meant going from $0 a week to $200 a week. Everything else after that has been gravy. And that's kind of like how you work if you're a Biennale College filmmaker. You go from zero budget to €200,000 budget, but you don't have a situation like in Cedric Kahn's film here, Making Of, where, you know, €1 million are pulled out from under you because you don't have a happy ending. You do the film you want to do.
Right.
So you go from zero to $200,000 and do the film you want to do. And the 3 films are from Mexico, Lumbren Sueño, from Italy, The Year of the Egg, and from Hungary, Adri. Please go to RogerEbert.com and look at my Venice diary. The 3rd entry of it has my thoughts on the Biennale College films. Mm-hmm. You know, in 2015, things have changed so much. It's less than 10 years, but I remember in 2015, I was the schmuck who went on the panel and said, you know, streaming services are going to be a really great conduit for art cinema. Now I realize that streaming services want to kill art cinema, and they want to kill all cinema, and it's gone from my glass house, and I went on a rant.
Hopefully no one will ever find out about that. Oh, whoops.
Yeah, no, I don't care, you know. But the filmmakers were very right on to me as I was yelling about streaming services, so that was good. But the films are worth seeing. They're worth keeping up with. I hope to be reporting on them more as time goes on. Films that have come out from the college and have shaken up cinema a bit include This Is Not a Burial, This Is a Resurrection, mm-hmm. The Fitz, The Cathedral, this year, My Father the Devil, all excellent films, all very different from one another. So look out for Biennale College cinema, I implore you.
Yeah. Well, shall we go from, I was going to say cradle to grave, but to the posthumous film that you've seen?
William Friedkin's The Caine Mutiny
Court Martial.
You know, I don't think Friedkin thought this was necessarily going to be his last film when he was making this, but if it has to be his last film, it kind of comes full circle with The People versus Paul Crump, which was about the American justice system, his 1962 made-for-television documentary. This is an adaptation of a pretty well-worn piece of material, which made me cock an eyebrow when I first heard about it, but Friedkin has subjected it to a very intelligent rewrite that that puts it into the 21st century and the Persian Gulf, and also expresses a kind of point of view that's surprisingly conservative. It's almost like the film's message is Jack Nicholson's You Want Us on That Wall speech from A Few Good Men, only not played for irony. But it's a very intelligent film made under constraint. He does it as if the play was written. He doesn't do flashbacks to the actual event of the mutiny.
Yeah.
He keeps it in the courtroom, in the corridors outside the courtroom, in a little coda in a hotel room.
Yeah.
And like Hitchcock would, you know, make films under constraint, Lifeboat, Rope, and he tries to keep things interesting with film, very basic but very sophisticated film language, camera movement, cutting, and of course great acting.
Mm-hmm.
For some it worked. I was one of the people for whom it worked. The British critic Caspar Salmon, who I just saw, he wrote about it in the Daily Beast. He was not a fan. But, okay.
And the actors, just in case people don't know, I guess...
Jason Clarke as the defense attorney playing another dogged interrogator, yeah. as in Oppenheimer. And
right.
Kiefer Sutherland is Commander Queeg. This is the kind of role that gives actors nightmares, because how are you going to top Bogart? He does it by channeling Dick Cheney and Greg Gutfeld simultaneously.
Cheney is right, yeah.
Pretty nice.
Yeah, but kind of like a better Cheney. Like.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. It kept my attention. And, you know, unlike Roman Polanski, who's a few years older than William Friedkin and must think he's going to live forever, but... Because if I was 87 and making a film, I'd be making every film like it was my last.
Right.
And The Palace is such a, aside from being some of the poorest filmmaking he's done in years, is such a spiteful little trifle that I can't believe, you know, he devoted so much time to its creation.
Yeah, a real stinker.
And, you know, we were talking earlier about the three problematic men of the Biennale, being Luc Besson, I talked about Dog Men,
yep.
and Polanski, and then Woody Allen, whose new film, Coup de Chance, is really good. It's tight, it's fleet, it makes its point rather well. It's not an overt comedy in terms of sight gags and verbal jokes, but it is a comedy in terms of its... in the classical sense of its ending, and also just the way it's framed. Robbie Collins said this, but I thought of it before I read Robbie Collins saying it, so I can take credit too. It is essentially the world's longest mother-in-law joke, but it's a movie about, yeah. you know, marriage, infidelity, and murder, the way that Match Point is and the way that Crimes and Misdemeanors is, but... I don't know, maybe because he had to make it in French, maybe he did more drafts of the script than he normally does, because most of his films lately have this tossed-off quality. I've often said, and I said this to you when we were first talking a couple of days ago, that Allen approaches filmmaking the way professional basketball players approach free throw practice, just sort of like, it's one... You know.
Yeah.
but in this case, I think he had to take a certain amount of care. And it shows. It actually shows. The movie is crackling good fun. I mean, if you're not a person who will, you know, Google image search Jeffrey Epstein and Woody Allen every time somebody says something nice about Woody Allen, which I did, and that's what I got in my Twitter feed. If you're not that person, it's a film that you may enjoy, if it ever makes the United States. I don't know if it will.
I also want to make sure that we include that. I mean, you started out talking about early film that you really loved, that, I don't know if you want to say a few words about Poor Things.
I'm one of the most, you know, strident, I'll even call myself strident, I'm one of the most strident anti-Yorgos Lanthimos persons extant, and I literally went into Poor Things with my, you know, with my fingers clawing the armrests and my teeth gritted, and I a half hour in, I'm like, something's happening. I'm enjoying this. This is really good. This is great. It's in its way delightful. It's Lanthimos kind of expands his purposefully weird style and makes it mesh with the aesthetic of Alistair Gray, the Scottish writer whose novel this is adapted from. It's very Bride of Frankenstein. It's a horny Bride of Frankenstein. And the Emma Stone performance is remarkable and so committed. It's too weird a movie for her to get all the awards for. I think Carrie Mulligan's probably going to get all the awards for Maestro, which is not a great movie, but is a great performance from her. But Emma Stone deserves the Nobel for this performance. It's also just a fucking fun movie.
And it's so much fun.
It's so much fun, yeah. As is David Fincher's The Killer. That's another fun movie. Our colleague Owen Gleiberman just walked by.
Oh, really? And,
he wrote in his Variety review that he says, well, maybe this movie isn't as deep as Fincher thinks it is. I don't think Fincher thinks it's a deep movie. I think Fincher very deliberately decided with this film to make something, to not make an important film.
Okay.
And that comes across. And it's fun. It's a lot of fun.
I had fun with that one, too. I mean, I don't know. My reaction to it is I watched it and I thought, you know, after Mank, it's like he wanted to just come back to a very focused sort of familiar territory,
yeah.
and just do this perfectly controlled.
It's another movie that moves like crazy, yeah, exactly. Even though the fact that the first half hour is one scene that's mostly in one room. But he, again, like Friedkin, incredible command of film language,
yeah.
Really makes every shot count.
Yeah.
It's such a pleasure to watch something where every frame is massaged but it doesn't feel labored.
What did you think of Michael Fassbender?
I loved him. I thought he was great. I mean, people have been sort of like, well, whatever happened to Michael Fassbender? Well, I don't know what happened to him, but he's doing good work. He's come back and he's doing good work. And you know, there's a fight scene at the center of the film that recollected the fight scene between Michael Fassbender and Gina Carano in Steven Soderbergh's Haywire. You know, Soderbergh and Fincher are great friends, so I think there's a connection there. It's like Steven and David kicking the crap out of Michael Fassbender since 2011.
You know what I also thought of, because the fight takes, it's in Florida, he goes out of Florida. Yeah. I thought of, I always forget the title, Amber.
Darker Than Amber.
Darker than Amber.
The Darker Than Amber fight was a direct inspiration for the fight in Haywire.
Oh, okay.
In fact, I'll tell you, It was Lem Dobbs, the writer of Haywire, who showed the Darker Than Amber scene to Steven Soderbergh and said, this is what we got to do. And
okay.
Steven was completely along for the ride. It's funny. Steven knows a lot about movies, but Lem Dobbs knows even more.
Yeah.
he's a real repository, and especially genre films. So
yeah,
that was a direct inspiration.
Okay, so there is a lineage. Okay,
yeah,
that's funny.
Total lineage. You got it.
Yeah, I mean, the killer, it was... I also did feel it had a certain amount of depth, because I did...
Yeah, no, it's not completely shallow.
No, I mean, I do buy the thing of it being in capitalism, and dog-eat-dog. And
it's a funny thing, too, because the other film... There's another film here called Hitman, the Richard Linklater film, which is also a lot of fun.
Yes, so much fun.
It's not, if you think, oh no, there's two films about paid assassins in this movie, you're wrong, because the premise of Hitman explicitly stipulates that there's no such thing as a hitman.
Right.
They say this over and over. Paid assassins are not a thing. Glenn Powell plays a guy who impersonates a paid assassin in entrapment schemes sponsored by police departments.
Yeah.
All paid assassins are in fact policemen. You have to see the movie to make it. And the movie itself is wacky. It's nerve-wracking and charming at the same time, because the things that these very likable rooting interests get up to, these are not ethically endorsable things.
No.
You know, if you remember Richard's film Bernie with Jack Black and Shirley MacLaine, this is in a similar moral gray area.
Right.
Which makes it kind of uncomfortable at the same time that it's very much fun.
Well, I hope it doesn't reflect badly on me that I didn't really think about that.
Yeah, no.
It just felt like
stiff, but I when I mentioned that to certain people, they're like, yeah, I didn't think of that. fuck those guys.
Your quaint morality.
We are beyond your, was the line in Apocalypse Now, we're beyond your timid lying morality.
That's Hitman, and what was it? Yeah, it was. And then Aggro Drift.
My God, Aggro Drift is interesting structurally because it does follow a linear storyline, but it doesn't feel like it's following a linear storyline because it keeps reiterating all these inane bits of dialogue. I am an assassin. I want you, honey. You know, all that, and it's just over and over again. It's like it's very recursive in a very deliberate way, and it reminded me of the whole aesthetic of the movie. I mean, even without the infrared, the aesthetic of the movie is kind of like circa turn of the century video game cutscenes combined with the fake grandeur of like a Lucio Fulci sword and sorcerer movie.
Yeah. And then as if it's a sample repeated and repeated.
Right. Both of which are things that Harmony Korine is highly conversant with. I'm not pulling the Lucio Fulci shit out of my fundament here.
Yeah, and it's funny. It's also funny, this kind of repeating of, you know, I'm a killer. That's also something that happens in Hitman when he's trying to talk himself up. He's like, I'm a killer. So it's kind of funny that they're all talking themselves up.
Now, the guy who's the lead in the Harmony Korine film is also in Pet Shop Days.
Yes, yes.
Which is a movie I wanted to like and kind of just didn't quite connect with. But you liked that movie.
I did like it. I mean, I sort of had the light bulb halfway through. It's like, oh, because I had read something where he's like every single filmmaker who's ever interviewed. It's like, I like 70s movies. Yeah. I like Cassavetes. But I'm like, no, I think you like the Safdie brothers. And you kind of want it, because that's what it is. You know, even down to the type of cinematography.
That's true. You know, Jorge Mola is the guy in both Pet Shop Boys and Aggro Dreams.
And this just kind of, with a protagonist who's just kind of run amok, and you're just kind of struggling to keep up with all the craziness they're getting into, and they're just constantly hyped up. So that's what it felt to me, and I went along with it. It's another one that really keeps moving. So I wasn't expecting too much one way or another, but yeah, it was interesting.
So we're doing a lightning round today because we want to keep it down to a half hour, because that's the format of the podcast, but also because we're both tired. We are going home tomorrow.
Yeah. One more film and then maybe we can get to the restorations. Right. But did you just mention that you saw Making Of?
I did see Making Of, Cedric Kahn's Making Of. Cedric Kahn's a French filmmaker of some repute. And this is a really clever concept about a film that's about a strike, a workers' strike, that is based on a true story. Not a true story in our lives, but a true story within the world of the film. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're making this film, and it's very gritty. And there's a young kid on the set who's an extra who wants to write scripts, who the ticked off director fires the kid who's doing the actual Making Of EPK film, mm-hmm. and hires this script kid to do it, and records this session with the producers, who tell him that if he doesn't shoot the happy ending that he originally submitted, which mm-hmm. was submitted by accident, that they're going to pull a million euros out of the production. Uh-huh. So it's just very, very complicated, and he ends up in a lot of trouble, and this kid who's this ambitious script writer, you know, is shooting it all on a video camera. And it's very funny, and it's very... Actually, I think it was stronger when it leaned into comedy more than the drama, because the kid sort of gets a crush on the lead actor and actress, and he acts like a bit of a jackass, and it's a little too edgy.
That was one that I missed. I don't even know. I think it was just... I think it was like that was going to be my 10 p.m. screening, but I think we both found...
Yeah, 10 p.m. screenings don't work for me in Venice. It's a tough thing because I like to see a lot of films when I'm here, and I did see a lot of films. I saw 20 films plus 5 before I left. Mm-hmm. But I find that a 10 p.m. screening really screws in my judgment because of the time difference. So I saw the Polanski film at a 10 p.m. screening, mm-hmm. and what happened was I was so wanting for it to be good, because mm-hmm. the last one that was here, Jacques Hughes, was very good.
Yeah.
But I wanted so much for it to be good that I'm sitting there like making up how it's not bad. It literally took me about 15 hours after getting out of that screening for it to sink in how awful it was. And I'm like, I can't trust my own judgment at a 10 p.m. screening.
Yeah.
Although I saw Hitman at a 9:45 screening, and that is actually good.
Well, I mean, that one's just kind of effervescent. It keeps you going.
But I can't do that.
Maybe we can end on a couple restorations.
Yeah, I only saw a couple of restorations. I mean, the classics section also contains documentaries, mm-hmm. one of which was Frank Capra, Mr. America, which is a very good documentary about Frank Capra, uh-huh. which features my friend Farron Smith-Nemi talking about the Man on the Flying Trapeze sequence, and it happens one night. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the heart of this documentary, her discussing that film and that scene and how Claudette Colbert didn't want to be in the film. And how Claudette Colbert, during the shooting of that scene and seeing her personal assistant really getting into what was happening, she realized she may have stumbled into something with real appeal for real people. Mm. And that is a real, more than almost any other Capra film. I mean, the films he did afterwards, Meet John Doe, they're about idealized real people. But It Happened One Night it's just a gem of a film. So that's a great little documentary. Yeah. I saw a funny television film that Orson Welles shot for his... Be My Guest or At Your Pleasure or whatever the name of his show was. He did an omnibus show. And it's an interesting thing. It's supposed to be a portrait of Gina Lola Brigida. But he's running around Italy. He's interviewing Rosano Brazzi. He's interviewing Vittorio De Sica. And he's asking them rather pointed questions about, you know, why Rosano Brazzi is a bigger star in America than he is in Italy. Hmm. You know, and what's going on with Gina Lola Brigida suing the talent. You see a lot in this film of the kind of ideas and technique that went into F for Fake. The phony intercutting, mm-hmm. you know, intercutting between two locations that are, you know, in reality miles or maybe continents away from each other and making it look like they're talking to each other. That's also a feature of Other Side of the Wind, you know, the famous Rich Little, you know, just raise your legs like you're avoiding these dwarves, you know. where are the dwarves? We'll shoot the dwarves later. Yeah. So that was interesting, and I hope that comes to New York. I saw the restoration of a film by the Mexican director Arturo Ripstein called Deep Crimson, which is a 1996 film that did very well at the Venice Film Festival when it played here, and Roman Polanski was the jury head of that year.
No kidding.
He wanted to award it everything, but it was the it got three awards, and it necessitated a change in the Venice rules so that no single film could get three awards or more.
Okay.
But it's a it's one of the darkest movies I've ever seen. It's another Honeymoon Killers, the real-life Honeymoon Killers case in the United States has inspired several films, including, of course, the Honeymoon Killers. And this is, it sets that Honeymoon Killers, this weird, obsessive couple roaming a horrible landscape of their native country, trying to commit extortion, but instead committing horrible murders. It's 2 hours and 10 minutes, and it's just ruthless and dark and literally jaw-dropping. Like, the last 40 minutes of the movie, I was sort of like, I can't believe they're doing this.
Is it just like that they're totally remorseless, or is it grisly? Or
It's a little grisly, but you can't believe how sick these people are.
Okay.
They're literally the sickest people you could ever imagine. Finally, today I saw Andrei Rublev.
And on a holy note.
Which is a really sacred object of cinema and so inspiring. And I was so glad because one of the filmmakers from the Venice Biennale was there in the audience, which was great. Claudio Casale, great guy, interesting director, L'Anno del Ovo. You know, we both walked out of that film thinking, that's so inspiring, because the movie is about art making.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing is just art making. The whole business, it's a 3-hour movie, and the last 40 minutes are the casting of a bell. It's a legendary scene where the young actor who had been in Tarkovsky's debut film,
Ivan's
Childhood, that young actor is in this as this snotty young kid who claims he has the... It's like, well, my whole family's been wiped out by the plague, but my dad, before he died, he taught me the secret of bell making. And he takes charge of this project, and he acts just like a film director. He yells at people, he fires people, he has people flogged. Eventually, the bell comes out, and it rings, and the kid's crying. The kid runs off by himself and cries.
All right.
And Andrei Rublev, who's been under a vow of silence for the past 10 years, breaks his silence to say, "Why are you crying?" And the kid says, "My dad never taught me the secret of bell making. He died. He never said a word about it to me." And this is the grand metaphor that Andrei Rublev has to say about art. It's a very amazing exposure of Andrei Tarkovsky, who did see himself, you know, kind of as a figure for canonization. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was very serious. He wasn't shy about his aspirations, and he wasn't shy about what he felt he achieved, except what he felt he achieved is what he achieved. So what are you going to do? It's a 3-hour movie.
How did it look?
It looked good. It wasn't like, oh my God, this is a whole new world. I think, you know, I'm not sure what version the Criterion Collection has for its Blu-ray, but it looks fine there. But this is just nice to see on a big screen.
Yeah.
You know, it needs size. It's a wide gauge film. The camera movement is in this horizontal mode that is very compelling. You know, when I first saw it, it's one of those films I've grown familiar with over the years. And, you know, it used to feel like a piece of slow cinema, and it's certainly very deliberate. But it doesn't take too many repeat viewings to appreciate the fact a lot of shit happens in this movie.
Yeah.
It's just, it's often rather kind of oblique about in the way it feeds you the narrative, but there's a lot of stuff happening.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, there's some stuff with animals that is not.
Doesn't age well,
but it probably didn't age well then. Reflection maybe of, to a certain extent, Tarkovsky's arrogance. But it's an amazing film. It's an amazing achievement. And it was a great way to go out of the festival, because you're watching it and you're like going, this film is one of the top 100 answers to the question, why movies?
Yep.
You know, maybe even one of the top 20. It's just that good. And it's that dazzling is the word.
probably ideal place to end.
Thank you. This has been a fun lightning round of Last Thing I Saw. We can be concise when we really are motivated and we want to go to bed.
By exhaustion.
We'll see you all in New York, people. Yes.
Thank you, Glenn.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with your host, Nicholas Rapold. Please consider signing up at rapold.substack.com. Thank you for listening.